Good morning and welcome into the show. It is Daniel Ortman coming to you live from the Dreamagine Sports Studios. This is 8 a.m. East Coast time, 5 a.m. really early out there on the West Coast. So if you're up and you're watching and you're listening and you're getting ready for work, kudos to you. I rarely ever want to see 5 a.m. So, you know, there's like a section of time on my clock every 24 hours that there's some hours that I really just don't want my eyelids open for. 5 a.m. seems to be right in the middle of that zone. So, yeah, kudos to you if you're up and watching. Welcome into the show. It is Wednesday, December the 4th. Thanks for tuning in. I wanted to kick off the show. We're going to be joined here in a few minutes by Nate Abarella, and I'm sure I butchered his name. We'll see if I get it right here in a moment. But I wanted to open the show talking about how we build deep, lasting relationships and fill gaps in the country. How we build deep relationships and how we fill gaps in the country. And what really brought this to mind was an article in the New York Times. And this article is about Bury, that, 3 months ago, the club was pretty much just dissolved. And 3 months later, there's no infrastructure, but the club still exists in the form of five people who still go to the stadium every day. There's no phone, there's no heating, but the grass is still being cut. And this is a story in the New York Times. Their soccer club vanished. They kept coming. A story of pride, boredom, loss, and loyalty. And I encourage you to check it out. It's by Rory Smith. And it really got me thinking about how do we create these kinds of relationships across the U.S. with our football clubs, with our soccer clubs? How do we build long-lasting, loyal, deep relationships? Now, we've talked about on this show the idea of being in the community, for the community, and with the community. This idea that we have to build long-term relationships that may not pay off financially for years to come, but will eventually set us up for a generational relationship, a lifelong relationship that will far in the long run pay off beyond a short-term transactional, very surface or shallow relationship. So I really wanted to start the show today kind of looking at how do we build these deep, lasting relationships and how do we begin to fill the gaps across the United States when it comes to clubs and communities? Because I think those questions, or that main central question, is answered in a both and scenario. I don't think a club can operate on an island. I think if you put a club somewhere and there's nothing close by, it will never reach its potential. Football clubs, to me, are organizations that thrive on local competition. And local does not necessarily mean that it has to be as close as, say, a Liverpool and Everton. But it has to be close enough that both fan bases interact, like a large majority of fan bases interact. This is why college sports in America should be a model that we look at, in my opinion, as part of a solution to this question of how we build deep, long-lasting relationships and fill the gaps in the country. For a long time, we have tried to fit a European solution on a continent-sized country. Most countries in Europe are the size of a state or a couple states, a few states maybe in the United States. We are a huge country from a geographic standpoint. Massive. So when we look to leagues like the Premier League, we look to La Liga in Spain, we see, you know, 20 teams. And so we think we need 20 teams in our first division. But we're not filling the gaps with 20 teams in our first division. We're not creating lifelong generational relationships because many of those fan bases are never going to intersect. They're never going to interact on a daily basis. You're never going to get the banter. College sports has provided us a great example, a great blueprint of what we could look at to answer this question, to solve this, to create a solution to what is a really, really substantive problem. People criticize Major League Soccer and the quality of the play, and all of those criticisms are valid. The quality of play is not very good. But that argument is brought up from the standpoint of MLS going, we're going to keep expanding. 32, now we're going to go to 34. They're going to keep going as long as they can. They'll go to 100 if they can. They are trying to solve the same question. And this is something that I don't think people realize. They are looking at the map too, and they're going, there are massive gaps in this country. How do we solve it? We put a team in Miami. We have a team in Orlando. We put a team in Atlanta. Now we add a team in Nashville, but there are still massive gaps in this country. You can go all over the country and you can look time and time again, even when you think, oh, we found a good place. Now we'll go and we'll look at Charlotte. But now you got Raleigh-Durham. You've got Knoxville. You've got Memphis. You've got New Orleans. You've got Birmingham, Alabama. You've got all these places, a market that's never talked about, Huntsville, Alabama, which will soon be the largest city in the state of Alabama, even bigger than Birmingham. No one's even talking about Huntsville. There are places around the country that are growing that could support multiple teams. So when we look at the answer to this question, how do we build lifelong, deep relationships, lasting relationships, and how do we fill the gaps? I think Major League Soccer is trying to figure this out for themselves in their own way. I don't like their solution. I don't like closed system soccer, but I do understand their need to expand. They need it for a couple of reasons. One, their business model is predicated on paying out to current owners expansion fees to help keep the thing going. It's maybe not quite a Ponzi scheme, but it's pretty close. So these numbers are going up, 50 now to 100, 150, 200, 250, 300, 350 million. You see these numbers going up. It's not because the demand has gotten so high that these territorial rights are worth $300 and $350 million on their face. If this was an open market bidding situation, it's not there. What's happening is it's an artificial scarcity market. And their model is predicated on getting these payouts to the rest of their owners. And so they can't dilute the payout. You're buying shares of a business. So if the 25 teams before you each put in money to buy an equity position that is equal to them, it means that your buy-in at that round has to be higher to get to the same equal percentage. But they setting aside that model, they understand that there are massive gaps in the market, that there is a massive pinned up demand, and they are trying to solve it their way. But the thing that we need to look at is the fact that they are trying to solve this question should give us hope. Not because they're going to come up with the answer, not because they're going to lead us there. The reason why that this should give us hope is that they too are seeing and feeling the problem. They too are seeing and feeling an opportunity, which only provides more evidence and more proof that this is a situation worth solving. How do we build lifelong, lasting relationships and fill the gaps in the country? I think the college model is the way. A few weeks ago, we talked about on the show the idea of how you kind of break these things down into super conferences. You create a scenario where fans interact on a daily basis. The reason why Michigan and Ohio State, Auburn, Alabama, Oklahoma, Texas, why these rivalries matter, Duke, North Carolina, fans interact on a daily basis. Proximity matters. Without it, a club being on an island is never going to reach that level of passion. It's never going to reach lifelong relationship. You move away, you will slowly wither and die in terms of your loyalty to that organization. Because you're so far away, you're never going to see them again. Because we're a massive country. And it doesn't mean that all fans will do that. But what I'm talking about is the energy level, the passion level. It's very, very difficult to psych yourself up when you are living 500 miles away or 1,000 miles away from your team. But when you are in a community, if you're in a pub, if you're in the stadium itself with hundreds, thousands of fans, and you're going crazy, all of those seeds of lifelong lasting relationships just keep building. And then you go to work and you're talking about the match. And you work, you have a coworker that roots for your biggest rival. And they're like, you're crazy. And you go back to them, you're crazy. And the banter continues. This is what we lack in the country. This is what we need in the country. How do we build lifelong lasting relationships? How do we fill the gaps? By doing both and. Now we change our mentality about relationships with communities. We quit asking what we can get out of you and from you. We start looking at how we can serve you. That's number one. And then we look at ways to connect with clubs and help other communities build clubs so that we have rivalries, that we have competition. If you're looking at this as a zero-sum game and we don't want any competitors, eventually you're going to be your own worst enemy because you will die. If you were to take the University of Alabama and pull it out of the middle of the SEC and pluck it out and drop it into Montana, eventually the Alabama you all know in college football, the passion level, the support, the crazy rabid fans, all of the resources and assets will slowly wither and die because it's out of its environment, it's out of its element, it's out of the SEC. There's no proximity. There's not Auburn fans running around the state of Montana. There's not LSU fans running around the state of Montana, but they are in the SEC. if we want our professional football clubs, our soccer clubs to become something deep, loyal, meaningful, we have to fill the gaps. We have to think even bigger than Major League Soccer. 34, we're not even scratching the surface. We're not even halfway there. We've got to get bigger. We've got to quit looking at this as European solutions stretched over an American continent-sized problem and start looking at adapting what we can learn from Europe and what we can learn from what works here and find a way to fill the gap with a workable solution. We need more, not less. The quality will come as we get more coverage, as we get more density of clubs, not less. Too many people are looking at this as we water down potential by adding more clubs. The truth is until we get to a place where we can adequately cover this country with scouting and resources, our talent pool is never going to grow to the level it could be with just a few dozen teams. We have to scale this thing out. We've got to start looking at our entire soccer ecosystem like a massive chain of stores. You've got to build a brand identity, which is the league system of connected leagues. You've got to build an identity of connected clubs all over this country so that you build density and proximity to a level where people can't escape it. You look at a city like Pittsburgh, a city like San Diego, a city like Albuquerque, New Mexico, San Antonio, Texas, New Orleans, Louisiana, Raleigh, North Carolina, Memphis, Tennessee. I could keep going over and over again, massive cities that could support a club at the highest level. And we think that they have to be at Division II just because we can only have 20 or 30 teams designated as D1? No. We need to open our minds and realize that building lifelong lasting relationships and closing the gaps, doing these things at the same time, will make everything stronger in the end. Speaking of making things better in your life and stronger, you need to build a better relationship with Ductic Brand. If you haven't already, go to DUKTIGBrand.com. If you use promo code DWSHOW, you will get 10% off of your order. It's the holiday season. They've got incredible products. If you haven't checked them out already, shame on you. Do it now. DuckTickBrand.com. Promo code DWSHOW and you will get 10% off of your order. We'll be right back after this. welcome back into the show this morning. Thanks for tuning in. We are pleased to be joined by Nate Abadea. Hopefully I didn't murder your last name, Nate. You are a well-known broadcaster, journalist, extraordinaire, covering the game down in Southern California and in Tijuana. Welcome to the show. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. And after that, I'd say solid B plus, maybe even up to an A minus performance on the Basque pronunciation on my last name there. I'm ready for this interview. I'm excited and ready to go. I'll bump you up to an A minus. Not bad.
Hey, I'll take it. You know, look, I'm not really into participation trophies, but I'll take the effort trophy, at least for trying. Right.
Absolutely.
So I appreciate that extra little bump for the A minus. My mom will be very happy that I'm maintaining an A average even to this day. That's good. That's good. So my mom is a retired school teacher. I'm married to a school teacher.
Yes.
Yeah. So great grades matter.
They'll both be proud to know that it was actually probably more like an 87, 88, but the effort and the good attitude that you had all semester is what got you up to the 91 there. So cheers.
Hey, listen, every now and then you just got to take whatever extra credit you can get, you know, because the grade matters more than what you actually know. At least that's
there you go.
The lesson too often in education.
That's how I got through college. So onward.
There we go. So look, I've been wanting to have you on the show for a while and love your work, love your enthusiasm about the sport. And before we kind of get into some of the things you worked on recently, I want to kind of go back even further. Where did this love affair for the sport begin for you? What was kind of the connecting point and what made it stick for you to continue to be such a big part of your life even today?
I would say that geographically and culturally, it began in a little town called Watsonville, California, which is on the central coast of the Golden State, Santa Cruz County. For those of y'all out there familiar with the Bay Area, San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose, that neck of the woods. I'm about an hour south where I grew up in Watsonville. And Watsonville is a very complex, unique place. And as far as ethnic makeup and cultural makeup, it's a place that's 75-80% Latino and predominantly Mexican-American. And I was raised on football Mexicano from the time I was old enough to know what a soccer ball was. I was playing in the streets from the time I was 3-4 years old and everything I could to get further and further connected to the game as a fan, as a young, 5-6 years old, saying I wanted to be a football writer. I wanted to be a football broadcaster. I wanted to be a soccer player. I wanted to be a soccer coach by the time I was like 9 or 10. It all was kind of a sped up growing process. And thankfully I've managed to do, I think, all of those except for the professional player. That was the one I was unable to accomplish, unfortunately. But I would have to give all credit to the hometown and the very heavily Mexican-American influenced upbringing in Watsonville. And one other thing that would tie into this answer to your question there is spiritually, some folks in England very much raised me. And I would say that a handful of individuals who were present in my Santa Cruz County upbringing and towns like Santa Cruz and Capitola, Aptos, up to San Jose, down to Monterey and Salinas, there was a lot of English expat influence in my life. And there was an old British pub called the Britannia Arms locally where we would go and watch games. And I became a Liverpool supporter by the time I was 5 years old. So Mexican soccer and British football, probably the two greatest influences in my life. And credit to both, credit to the strengths and flaws of both and all that they are to this day as the Premier League and broader English football and, of course, Liga MX are cornerstones of my life and even this little thing I like to call a career. So onward.
So you are a fan of the two biggest leagues in American soccer, right? So they're the most watched leagues, Liga MX in the Premier League. They are regularly getting the highest ratings in American viewership, American households. In terms of Watsonville, before we move on, describe the town, describe the city. You did mention a little bit of the demographics, but you know, in terms of a footballing culture, this is something that is in today's conversations about how do we grow the game. You know, U.S. soccer will ask sometimes these big macro questions at an AGM or at one of their council meetings or what have you. You know, how do we reach the unaffiliated, or how do we grow the game in the grassroots? What, you know, we don't have a long or deep and historic soccer culture, and yet you're describing a culture that really shaped you, you know, from the time you were in diapers, that really kind of molded you and guided you in this journey, this love affair with the game. So what was it like growing up there? I mean, was pickup, you know, were pickup games kind of part of the everyday thing? Was it, were there kind of these kind of Hispanic Latino leagues around that people played in? You know, what was the environment like for you as a kid growing up and playing in Watsonville, California?
To those last two kind of mini questions within there, yes and yes. Pickup soccer is everything in a place like Watsonville, playing whatever, wherever. I mean, it don't matter. You got nice grass, you got turf, you got a dirt lot, you got a street corner, you got a game. And that's always how it should be. And that's how it is a lot of places around the world. And mind you, there is plenty of regimented, strict practice, training, traditional, whatever you want to call it, soccer in Watsonville, and some great coaches and great youth programs and phenomenal high school programs, historically great public high school programs, specifically at my alma mater at Watsonville. There's also an uphill battle that most kids seemingly have to fight when they're from where I'm from, when they're from neighboring cities like Salinas. There's been a lot of really good journalism over the last couple years about the city of Salinas and Alisal High School and Nido de Football and what people call nests, you know, footballing nests where the game is nurtured and people are raised on this stuff and talent is cultivated in these places and it grows up and it becomes more and more talented and full of potential, and then it reaches that level of, well, what gets done with it when we're talking 16, 17 years old? And I've written extensively. I encourage everybody to have maybe a little bit better understanding as far as where I grew up and how it relates to everything I do for a living now and this conversation I'm having right now here with you, Daniel, to go on to medium.com and just search my name, and the name of the piece was Salinas and Watson, the cultural disconnect of American soccer. And it basically went into the pay-to-play system and everything that the system of player development that we have in this country, and how it very much ignores places like Watsonville and Salinas and countless others, whether it's the neglect, overall kind of neglect and disrespect towards the Latino population of this country, or if you want to look at it more from a socioeconomic point of view, or if you want to get real crazy and deep smart about it and combine them and look at the ethnic cultural segregation, for lack of a better way to put it, that really happens within our soccer nation, and you want to combine that with the socioeconomic reasoning and the consequences of the pay-to-play system, because it depends how much time you have. I always tell people how much time you have for the answer, how much time you have to do some research. So if you got more than 5 or 10 minutes, I encourage everybody out there listening right now to go check out that piece. You can Google it, just search Salinas and Watson, the cultural disconnect of American soccer, and you'll find out a lot more. Try to give you the Cliff Notes version right now of where I'm from and what it all means, but check out the piece for a little more info on that.
So you grow up in an area that is overlooked, disregarded. I would say there has been, even if it's not intentional, and I've talked about this on the show many times, even if it's not intentional, there is inherent discrimination built into the American soccer system by U.S. soccer. Even if it's even if that wasn't a conscious decision in the beginning, it's a byproduct of the choices yes. that have been made. And you know, we can sit here and ignore those or try to, you know, rationalize, well, that, you know, that wasn't our intent. Well, it doesn't matter what the intent was. It's still there. And and it's in Watsonville, it's in Salinas, it's in areas all across this country. There, you know, I talk about on the show, there are entire states that are locked out of the highest levels of American soccer. It's crazy to me that we put up with this in this type of system in a country like America. But it's one of the reasons why we have this show and why we talk about it and fight the fight each yeah. and every day. So you grow up, you obviously you're not living in Watsonville now. You're in Southern California in the San Diego area.
Yes.
And you said at a young age you wanted to do something covering the sport, playing the sport, if at all possible, being a professional player, and you acknowledge you didn't quite reach that goal. But you get to talk to professional players a lot, and you get to cover professional players a lot. So what was that like getting, you know, older and realizing that part of your dream coming true, being able to cover the sport and make a living in the game that you love in a way that you had interest in doing from a very young age?
I feel blessed and I feel privileged to be able to do what I do for a living and to know that I've followed a dream. I've followed a pathway that I like to think I was building and kind of laying out myself, and with the help of plenty of others and beautiful, beautiful people who have helped me or lended a hand or lended a kick in the ass or lended a word of advice from whenever it may have been all the way to this day right now. And being on this show with you, it's what it's all about, working as a freelance independent artist who happens to cover football for a living. And I've broadcasted every other sport known to mankind. I did years of high school football, minor league baseball. I broadcasted lacrosse at my alma mater of Humboldt State University. I've done cycling broadcasting, tennis broadcasting. If there's a paycheck and a microphone, you'll find me there. But the ultimate passion, and as I've always known, and where I think it's safe to say the greatest skill set is, and that's because of the romanticism and the upbringing and everything that's kind of ingrained inside me. It's within football. It's within the soccer world. And so I'm blessed and privileged to be not only working in professional soccer in my day-to-day life, but also working in one of the most unique soccer communities in the entire world. One of the most just unique places in the entire world in the sense of this cross-border community and the notion that we have a top-flight professional Liga MX team here in the Xolos of Club Tijuana and the stadium where Club America has to come and play a road game every year, where Tigres has to come, where all these big names of Mexican football, Monterrey, Chivas, not that, name them. They got to come here. It's something bigger than just Xolos. I always remind that to people. And the notion that Estadio Caliente hosts these games and has this club that we love here in this community. And Daniel, we're talking about something that's 20 miles from where I'm talking to you from right now here in San Diego. And it's in another country. You got to cross an international border to get to it. And you sometimes forget about that because to a lot of people, it's just the home team. It's the home team here, and we love them. And there's a lot of great soccer popping off here in San Diego in 2020 with the SD Loyal and the new USL team that's going to be in town. You got the San Diego Soccers, one of the longest running soccer brands in America, the Arena Soccer Stalwarts. You talk about American soccer nostalgia, man. The San Diego Soccers are still here and still exist. I broadcast their games. And so If It's Soccer in this cross-border community, you'll find me there as a writer, as a broadcaster, playing pickup to this day, still feeding the passion and watching matches in pubs. There's a great, great Premier League supporters culture that exists down here. There's just a fervent passion for Mexican soccer, not just with Cholos, but for the Mexican national team, for every other club damn near in Mexican football. You could find a representative of that club somewhere in San Diego County. That's the level of diversity and passion just within the Mexican game. And I think kind of putting a bow on that particular aspect of the discussion, I remember back during the 2018 World Cup and just all the kind of despair and stuff that I felt. Obviously, I would be the last person to deny that I felt despair, sadness, and heartbreak at the U.S. failing to qualify and failing to get a point in Cuba in October of 2017. And missing out on the 2018 World Cup. And the ultimate saving grace that happened here in San Diego was being a part of that tournament and every game, no matter where I was, no matter what pub, especially at my local watering hole, the Bluefoot Bar and Lounge here in just up the road in North Park here in San Diego. If you're ever in town, come on over to the Foot. Beautiful, beautiful place. And one of the homes of football passion here in San Diego. But at the Foot alone, I met people from all 32 countries. And these weren't, you know, people with long stories of, oh yeah, my grandpa was from so-and-so, and, you know, second, third generation. These are people who were, there were people here on J1s. There were people here on, you know, work trips through the summer. There were people who just moved to San Diego a few months ago. There's all these stories and just stories on stories and stories. And it was just such a microcosm of beautiful diversity, and it was so beautiful that it made me forget that the U.S. wasn't even playing. I by the end of the World Cup, I'd completely forgotten about the U.S.'s failure to qualify because I was shown another really important side of what this is all about. And we become so insular, we become so segregated, so in our own little worlds. And going back to what you were talking about as far as the way that our youth system works and the way that our system of player development works, I think it's very much the same principle at hand in terms of that insular, everybody keep it tight culture. And that's just not me. That's never going to be me. And so this last summer of 2018, back last year in San Diego, I think was the greatest example of such, where just at the Bluefoot, there were fans, natives of every country that took part, from Tunisia to Costa Rica to Nigeria to Argentina to England, Colombia, you name it. There was a representative from that country present in San Diego at my local bar. So much love to this cross-border community and much love to the beautiful game and the way it all ties together.
When we look at Southern California, for anyone who has never been there or is unfamiliar with the landscape, I have a lot of friends there, been there many times. My brother used to live in San Diego. I've been to that part of the world a lot. When you look at American soccer at large, one of the topics of conversation, even within the United States Soccer Federation, is that Southern California, in many people's eyes, is the hotbed of American soccer. There is, you know, passion there. There, obviously, as you've been talking about, even there in San Diego, the proximity to Tijuana and the club and the stadium and the matches, you know, feeds into that as well. As someone who is living there, working there, you know, taking in a World Cup in 2018 and you're meeting all these people, everyday life in Southern California, describe for the audience the kind of footballing environment there in terms of the passion level, the access to the game. You know, if there are kids that are, for example, you know, growing up that maybe have, you know, Mexican roots in their family, are they trying to make it through the American soccer system, or are they getting overlooked and having to go back across the border to get a shot? What is the environment like for someone on the outside curious about this hotbed of American soccer? What is the realities on the ground?
Well, the last little theoretical that you laid out right there is actually a reality for players in Southern California. It's a reality for players up from LaSalle High School in Salinas and Watsonville High School in my hometown. And again, go back to that article that I promoted earlier in the show, and go back to a few pieces in the Guardian and the LA Times over the last few years. Yes, it's something that's very much a reality in terms of the lack of opportunities given to hardworking young Latino players in all over California, from my original home up north on the Central Coast to the Los Angeles area and all the way down here to San Diego. But another thing that I kind of want to spotlight is the unique qualities, again, of where I'm specifically located. And when we talk Southern California, I think I'd be willing to wager that 99% of the people hearing this right now, when they hear Southern California, they think Los Angeles. And that's just kind of how the American brain works. Whether you're from California, you're from the East Coast, you're Middle America, it really don't matter. When you think SoCal, you think LA. And right. San Diego has this heavy, heavy chip on the shoulder that you could look at from a few different angles, but it's the LA chip. It's the notion that you sort of have Southern California, which is LA to everybody, and then you still have this whole market down here, this great soccer market that's been very underserved from a professional standpoint, always with the best TV ratings during World Cups and during even U.S. national team matches, Mexico national team matches. When you actually break down those Liga MX and Premier League TV numbers that you referenced here at the top of the show, San Diego, always number one, number two. There is a passion that exists in this community. It's so unique because you have the chip on the shoulder. We don't want to be LA. We don't want to be affiliated with just leftovers or whatever, you know, South LA to the grander perspective. That's not what we are. We got our own thing going on down here. And it can be a bit of a double-edged sword. I'll say that with no qualms, that level of, dare I say, insecurity sometimes can come back to bite people and maybe give what comes out, I think, often, hopefully not too often, but at least in the 4 years that I've lived here, I've seen quite a bit, which is an inferiority complex that comes from, and I'm just talking on a grander, this is away from, you know, the socioeconomic consequences of and discrepancies and evil of the pay-to-play system. I mean more on a broader footballing level, and really you could say actually on a broader sports level. And I got here right when the San Diego Chargers were moved up to LA and that whole fiasco. I was here when San Diego was fighting to get an MLS team and that failed. And there's all this backstory and kind of backlog stuff of San Diego specifically, which is that it's just the city that can't get anything done. It's just the city that has this chip on the shoulder. It's in LA's shadow. You got the Xolos, and the Xolos tapped into that. The Xolos took full advantage of that. They came into the San Diego market and said, hey, we're here. Come on down. Let's host you anytime you want to come on down to our games. And Xolos, 5 years after being founded and 1 year after being promoted in 2011, won a championship. They won Liga MX in 2012 in their first full year after getting promoted to the top flight. And there's a lot of people, Daniel, who think back to that 2012 championship who were on the U.S. side of the border. And when they reference it, they go, that's the only championship, the only top flight championship that San Diego's won ever. I mean, when you actually think about it, the San Diego Padres have never won a World Series. Chargers never won a Super Bowl, and they boned out of town. You had two NBA teams who left back in the day. The city of San Diego, apart from the arena soccer history of the Soccers, I don't want to overlook that because that's some beautiful stuff. And there's 14 banners hanging up in the rafters at the old sports arena. But apart from that, let's just say outdoor professional sports, yeah, there's never been a championship in this city. And there's a chip that exists. It's a heavy, heavy chip. And I can't wait to see how SD Loyal, this USL team, how they harness that in the right ways. Because a chip, a quote-unquote inferiority complex, it can be channeled in the right way. It really, really can. So let's channel that passion and that energy in a positive way moving forward into 2020. So I hope I kept that succinct and that all tied together there, sir.
No, that works. I do have a question. You talk about San Diego not being able to get things done. Why is that? Why is it? Because it's a great city. It is my second favorite city in California. And no, my favorite is not LA. It's San Francisco, because my favorite city in the whole world is New York. And so I love the density of San Francisco proper. But I love San Diego. If my family had to pick anywhere to live in California, they would live in San Diego, not San Francisco. So I would be in San Diego as well. They would win out in that fight. But when you look at San Diego and all of the things that you mentioned that they have going for it, it's an incredible city. You right. can get around the city pretty well. The downtown has been revitalized over the last 20 years. It's incredible. Why is it that the city has been unable to really leverage its assets and resources to build something, you know, local? I mean, yes, I get the television numbers, but to your own teams, I mean, you know, you've got San Diego 1904 that played in NISA this year. You've got the USL San Diego Loyal coming in, the San Diego yeah. Soccers, the Chargers, they left. You mentioned the NBA teams that left. You have the Padres still there. Why is it that on a sporting sense, the city has been unable to really capture the market and make something, you know, really, really successful, especially from a championship standpoint, but also just from an operating standpoint, to be able to keep, you know, these teams around and growing and operating?
Well, I want to take this opportunity to actually shout out SD Loyal, because one of the things that was really cool in the way that they built this club from the start and got the logo out and got the push for 2020, and they are going to play in the spring of 2020, playing games at Torero Stadium out at the University of San Diego. A beautiful, beautiful stadium, great intimate atmosphere. I can't wait for those games in 2020. But shout out to SD Loyal, because it relates specifically to this question that you asked. It's really funny what they did, where they went and had these focus groups all over town, and they talked to people about what the problems are and tried to find answers to the questions that you're asking me right now. And then sort of at the end of all of it, kind of flipped it on its head and said, okay, we've heard that excuse before, or let's not call it an excuse. We've heard that reasoning before. We've heard, this is why it doesn't work. This is why everyone's a transplant. No one has any, you know, real ties to the ground that they stand on, and all of these different things. And you hear people out, and you definitely give people the time of day, and you don't reject anyone's idea. You hear everyone's thoughts, and then you kind of rattle with them a little bit. You think about them. And what SD Loyal did is they heard a lot of that and processed it and then flipped it on its head and said, okay, we hear you, but those also, a lot of them, sound a little bit like excuses and like built-in excuses for things not working. What if we just came with the attitude, knowing that there's a little bit of that quote-unquote inferiority complex, the little bit of quote-unquote insecurity or chip on the shoulder, and what if we channeled that in the best way possible by kind of just completely ignoring it and going, no, we're not going to let that plague the back of our minds with every decision that we make from here on. We are SD Loyal. We are loyal to San Diego, loyal to the soil, 2020. Let's get this thing moving forward. This is for the next generation. We ain't going nowhere. And that was the message that they came with. That was the message that I got to give to the people of San Diego during just a fabulous unveiling ceremony event back in early November, about a month ago. Actually, it was such a cool thing. And the notion that was the message that I was instructed to convey to people, that meant a lot to me, because that was different. I've heard all of the excuses. I've heard all of the reasoning for why it doesn't work here in San Diego, why it's never going to happen, why this city. And I get it. I get the cynicism. I get the sarcasm and cynicism and just eye roll vibe that a lot of people have, going, ah, here comes another thing that's going to come and go. Here comes another failed project. and SD Loyal went around town and they listened to everybody and then said, okay, well, what if we do it this way? What if we just come in and own this thing and do it for the people and do it for all the right reasons and do it in all the right ways? So I'm excited to see where that project goes, because defeating San Diego sporting pessimism, that is that's a fight for not for the faint of heart. And I've got a lot of faith in this team and the management and the people running it. And I can't wait to see where it goes.
In terms of, you know, this head start that Tijuana has on the San Diego market, and now the San Diego Loyal coming into the USL Championship are going to try to establish themselves, a year after the San Diego 1904 have tried to establish themselves in that market. What do you look at in terms of knowing that area? What do you look at in terms of the opportunities, the possibilities, the potential of San Diego in your mind? I know they've flirted with the idea of trying to flash eyes at Don Garber in the past and figure out a way to get an MLS team. And not to say that the San Diego Loyal couldn't eventually do the same thing going through what seems to be the conventional route these days, which is to come into USL, show that you're viable, and then flash eyes again at Don Garber, and then you get to come into to MLS. But whatever the pathway, what do you see as the possibilities there for potential in San Diego support? Is it always going to be in the shadow of Tijuana? Or do you think that you can build a big, viable, vibrant football club right in the heart of San Diego?
I would say yes, unequivocally yes to that last question. We can do this. And I like to think that the little bitty role that I play, it's one that I'm blessed to play. And I call myself a voice of the cross-border soccer community, a voice of the cross-border community at large, where I'm on the ground in two countries most days of the week. I'm working in TJ 2 to 3 days a week for the last couple of years. I'm here in San Diego, living, working, playing, having a great time, and making sure that this fusion exists to the best of my potential. And mind you, I've got a small little role to play, but if more people could think of it like this, I would like to think that we'd be better for it. And I think that the folks from SD Loyal have gotten this more than anyone, but the folks from the San Diego Soccers have gotten this over the last couple of years. Let's not forget that the San Diego Soccers, the arena soccer team here in SD, brought Landon Donovan out of retirement last year to play arena soccer. And it was a hit. It was wild. It was fun. And it helped to fuse some things together. And now look at Landon venturing into coaching and being the first manager of this SD Loyal team going into this USL campaign, and tying that back to Xolos. Credit to them, tip of the hat to them, where that's always been their attitude. Going when the rumors, the original Soccer City SD MLS rumors started circling, and people at Xolos were asked, are you guys worried about this? What are your thoughts? And everyone from ownership all the way down to management, coaches, everyone going, more soccer in San Diego, more soccer in our community. The more soccer, the better. I think this was back when El Piojo was the manager, Miguel Herrera was managing Xolos back in 2016. I remember Piojo getting asked a question about it, and he went, you kidding me? Like, sounds great. Wonderful. More soccer, the better. The more, the merrier. Let's keep this thing going. And obviously, that doesn't work everywhere. In a lot of communities, I would be willing to bet some people would disagree with me and say that no, here it's about kind of harnessing one club, getting as much energy to one thing, because we can't spread our resources too far and spread ourselves too thin and have too many things going on. And sometimes too much competition can be a bad thing. And I get that. And here it's different. Here, this is a place where it's big enough to support multiple teams. Multiple teams, in my opinion, if they're done right and if they're pushing each other in the right way, it's a fusion and it's a beautiful, beautiful thing. The notion that the San Diego Soccers, the Xolos of Club Tijuana, SD Loyal, 1904, AFC San Diego. I could keep going. San Diego State, Aztecs, college soccer. I could keep on going all the way down to the 150 bajillion youth clubs around San Diego. Some of them get it. Some of them don't. There are some people who have a, I like to call it a squirrel and a nut approach, where it's just, you know, mine. It's like, dude, there's a whole tree of them right over there. What are you tripping out about this one little acorn? But that's the mindset that plagues a lot of people. And that's not just here in San Diego. That's all around our soccer nation in the United States. I think that's something that people need to kind of look in the mirror and check in with and learn how to, not be like, and learn how to have a little bit more ability to share, and that with sharing comes a good competition and a good push from your peers. And so shout out to Xolos, shout out to the Sockers, and shout out to SD Loyal. Really, first and foremost, those three names have just been adamant over the last few months and going back years with the Xolos and the Sockers of being a part of a grander cross-border soccer community that exists 12 months a year, no less, always going on. There's always soccer. There's always a match on at the pub. Support your local watering hole that shows matches. Support your local Liga MX team. Support your local Football Rapido Arena soccer team. Support your USL team, your NISA team, your whatever. If it's football, it's football. It's local. It's yours. Have it.
Last question. As someone who is there in a cross-border city, you're in a unique kind of perspective, and you're living this kind of cross-border life in back and forth. You have a first division club in Liga MX right there. You have the San Diego Loyal trying to launch in the spring with the USL Championship, which is in Division Two, and we just talked about like multiple clubs and what have you. One of the things when you look at the United States, we're a continent-sized country. We have massive cities all over this country, cities that are as big or bigger than a lot of these European cities that host clubs that we all know and that we follow and that we support. And some of these cities overseas have multiple clubs and successful clubs. It may not all be first division, but they're you know, sizable clubs, and some of them are, you know, first division clubs. You know, my family, for example, this summer we were in Europe, and we stopped in Liverpool, and you know, to see from the stadium and look out in less than a mile away is Goodison Park, and you can see Everton. I mean, it's like right there. You feel like you could just throw a baseball or a football and a frisbee and hit the stadium. It's a short walk to get to Everton's grounds, and you look, kind of zoom back out, you look back at the United States with your perspective, where you are, and looking at the size of San Diego, looking at the size of American cities. What is the potential of American soccer if we ever get it right? Can we be at the top of the heap in the global game if we ever, you know, align all of our resources together in terms of a system to be able to leverage these massive, huge cities all over this country?
I would like to think yes. I would like to err on the side of hopefulness, but that's a big ask of a lot of people. And I don't just mean the people in power who we need to get to and possibly dethrone eventually. And we could get into a whole other discussion as far as leadership and the trickle-down effects of corruption and greed and all the things that we've kind of alluded to in regards to the pay-to-play system and systems of player development and the squirrel syndrome that I talked about, people being very protective of their small amount of resources or large amount of resources, whatever it is, the insular cultures that very much plague us as a soccer country and growing the game. And so I go back to the development. I go back to the youth and the evils of pay to play and what who I should say is blocked out by this system. It's on us. It's on all of us to scout our own communities. It's on all of us to do everything that we can, street by street, block by block, and for the next generation. And if the more of us that have that mindset, the better we will be. And so wherever you are listening to this, it can apply to your small town. If you're in a big city listening to this, it can apply to your big city. It's a universal concept, a universal construct to me. The art, the idea of scouting your own communities and doing everything that you can, whether it's growing a club, whether it's growing players, cultivating talent. It all comes back to the same principle. And I think we're all capable of it. It's going to take some diligent effort and some real hard work and some gritty dirt in the nails for a lot of people. But I know a lot of people here in San Diego and Tijuana alone. And this is a unique concept here with the cross-border community, but specifically on the U.S. side of the border and going back up north to my hometown and way up to Northern California and all over this country, all over the state of California, just for me and how I've grown up. There are so many people willing to do this work. There are so many people who have been doing this work, who've been putting in these types of efforts. So I commend all of those people. If you out there are someone who identifies with anything that I'm spitting right now, I commend you and tip my cap to you. And I encourage you to continue and keep it going. And as much as I'd love to think about the World Cup 22 years or whatever from now, that maybe the U.S. will finally be at the top of the heap, I like to take it maybe a little bit more with a one step at a time approach and just go, where are you on the map? You know, I'm looking at a giant U.S. map in front of me right now, and I could just start popping pins all over it going, where are you? What are you doing? Where are you and what are you doing? And the more that we can keep in touch and keep pushing each other, whether we're in the same city, whether we're in a different state, let's keep it going. So that's my challenge and shout out to everyone out there. And to you as well, Daniel, you're doing a great service. A lot of folks who I've worked with over the last few years have great respect for your show and the voices that you give a platform to. So if you have a platform, take advantage of it, offer it to others who have similar goals and mindsets. And whether you're a broadcaster, you're a coach, you're a writer, you're a young player, we can all tie together and have these mindsets and be much better off for them and with them forevermore.
Absolutely. How can people, as we wrap up here, how can people get in touch with you, follow your work, follow you on social media? What's the best way for them to do that?
On Twitter, @ Nate Abaurrea, last name A-B-A-U-R-R-E-A, pronounced with 88% proficiency by one Daniel Workman at the opening of this interview, and I'm on Instagram and Facebook and the whole lot with the same handle @ Nate Abaurrea. So the Instagram is a fun place for all sorts of interactive soccer content, a little bit of the more millennial minded variety, and the Twitter is a cesspool of God knows what these days, but I like to keep my page classy and
me as well. Nate, thanks for joining the show. We really appreciate it. Glad to have you on, and hope everyone will take a minute to find your work and follow you on social media. You have great insights into the game, and good luck as you continue your quest in covering the sport and right there in San Diego. Thanks for joining the show, and we really appreciate your time. Our sponsor this half hour is Charity Water. To learn more about Charity Water, visit charitywater.org. We'll be right back after this.
No one, no man, no woman, no child should ever have to drink green water with bugs, with algae, with disease in it. bad water and a lack of toilets. Kills more people than all the wars in the world. We know how to bring clean drinking water right now to every single person on earth. And when you can bring water into communities, it truly transforms them. It changes everything. Right? You could know that you'd made a difference. You could know that you had truly impacted the life of a family, of a community, of a region. There was either clean water or there wasn't. We believe in a world where every single person has clean and safe water to drink, and we will continue fighting until that happens.
I'd like to thank Nate Abareya for joining us today on the show and spending some time with us talking about not just soccer in Southern California, but specifically in San Diego, Tijuana, where he grew up in Watsonville, California. His insights, I think, are really, really important things that we need to consider and listen and learn from this, you know, to really get our sport where it needs to be in this country. As always, you can watch the show on facebook.com/WRKMN or at danielworkman.com. Catch me on Twitter or Instagram at Daniel Workman. We'll see everyone again tomorrow.